From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. We value every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, sundown on Monday brings the Baha'i celebration of the birth of the Bab. Tuesday, Sikhs observe the installation of the scriptures of Guru Granth. Thursday is the Hindu feast of Dasara, and Ashura begins at sundown Thursday for Muslims. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
My confidence comes from knowing there is a force, a power, greater than myself, that I'm a part of and is also a part of me.
We're all interconnected. We're all in this together.
We start questioning things. Why is it like this? Is God the person with the old white beard?
What do you get when you combine 7 nights of primetime television, some leading documentary filmmakers, the history of the world's religion, and Oprah Winfrey? The answer is Belief, a miniseries premiering Sunday, October 18th on the OWN Television Network. I had the chance to attend a preview several weeks ago in Los Angeles, and yes, it was at Oprah's house. And on this week's show, I'll share my impressions and talk to executive producer David Smith.
Pope Francis opened the first session of the Synod on the Family. He said ultimately the Synod is not about negotiations, but about truth.
Right now, Catholic bishops are back at the Vatican for part two of the Extraordinary Synod on the Family. Internal tensions broke into the open last week when some conservative participants wrote a letter to the Pope complaining that the deck was stacked against them in the structure of the gathering itself. For a better understanding of what really goes on in Rome at a time like this, I'll be joined this week by the Most Reverend Bishop Francis Quinn. His bold op-ed on where Pope Francis should be steering the church appeared this week in the New York Times. But first,
on this stage, you didn't hear anyone denigrate women. You didn't hear anyone speak ill of another American because of their religious belief.
I think being the first woman president would be quite a change.
Are you saying you didn't know what you were voting for?
I just arrived the Senate.
I would say this. I've been waiting for 10 minutes.
Well, first of all,
this isn't been equal.
The American
time.
People are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
The Democratic candidates finally gathered on one stage for their first debate this week. How'd they do at addressing the issues we consider vital in America today? To explore the answer to that question, I'm happy to have investigative journalist Sarah Posner back with us today. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's nice to be back.
There was a lot of real substance in this Democratic debate. Do you think religion, specifically religious liberty, should have been included? Were you surprised that nothing was said about it?
And no, just because I felt like, and this was a good thing, the debate questions were really geared towards getting at some policy differences between the front-running candidates, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and to a lesser extent, Martin O'Malley. And those issues were issues of economic inequality and so forth, which were wrapped up into a bunch of different questions. Gun control, which I think was notable that there were Democrats on the stage who weren't afraid to take on the NRA, and then foreign policy. So I do think that there's time to talk about these religious liberty issues, but I think that they would be less contentious between the candidates. So I think it was okay that maybe they were saved for a later debate, because I think that this made for good TV and good debate watching to see the candidates talk about gun control, talk about economic inequality, talk about things like paid family leave. So I thought all of that was good. I wasn't bothered by the lack of the religious liberty question.
Well, you know, I have to agree with you, and I also have to admit that it was nice to hear a political discussion that didn't sound like a strategy for a theocracy.
Yes.
And
yes.
I do hope, and I want to ask you if you are optimistic that religious liberty will come up in the future and that we'll get something of the knowledge of where Democratic candidates are about a whole plethora of religious freedom issues.
Right. I mean, I do think that the question that needs to be asked of all of these Democratic candidates, if they were elected, what they would do with President Obama's Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a huge issue that not very many voters are tuned into because that hasn't gotten as much attention as the predecessor entity did under George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still this lingering question that you and I have talked about many times and that folks in the church-state separation and religious liberty advocacy community are really focused on, that Obama has not reversed that Bush-era memo within the Justice Department that allows nonprofits that receive federal funding for faith-based community and mm-hmm. social services activities that allows them to discriminate in hiring based on religion.
Right.
And I think that that should be something that should be put to the Democratic candidates. Your mm-hmm. predecessor promised that he would reverse this Bush-era policy. 8 years later, it hasn't been reversed. What would you do? Would you even keep the Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships?
Mm-hmm.
How would it look different? I doubt very much that they're going to be asked that question just because we're looking at so many more crucial mm-hmm. questions facing us, particularly foreign policy questions, the gun question, economic questions. But I really think that this would be a way of understanding possible differences between the Democratic candidates, because they're probably going to be very similar to each other on other questions, such as the extent to which people should be granted religious exemptions from having to mm-hmm. Participate in a same-sex wedding ceremony or
right.
something of that
right.
sort.
Yeah. I did, Sarah, think it was interesting that the person who is likely the most secular candidate was the one who spoke most fervently in terms of morality, talking about
yes.
the environment in those terms, even quoting Pope Francis. Did you find that approach by Bernie Sanders noteworthy?
I did find it noteworthy because you have candidates like Hillary Clinton, a devout Methodist, Martin O'Malley, a devout Catholic, and then Bernie Sanders, who's, you know, pretty much a secular Jew who went on Rosh Hashanah to speak at Liberty University, where he used very, very similar language as he did last night,
uh-huh.
which is fascinating, right? So you
uh-huh.
have someone who's Jewish but not observant, and I'm not, you know, passing a judgment on that. I'm just saying this is what he did on Rosh Hashanah, and I didn't think it was an inappropriate thing to do. Go talk at Liberty University and talk about trying to appeal to these evangelical students' sense of the moral imperatives within Christianity that aren't about, you know, abortion or same-sex marriage. And so I thought it was interesting that he framed it not in a religious pandery sort of way, but really framing climate change and economic inequality in these moral terms.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much on the gun question, which is something that's really interesting to me because I really have the sense that for religious lefties, gun control perhaps should be more of an out-front moral question.
Mm-hmm.
And it really hasn't been. And Sanders appears to be the weakest of those three on the gun control question. But yes, I thought it was fascinating that he was the one to put all of these issues in these very stark moral terms.
Sarah, were there other moments that just stood out for you as being worthy of more attention?
Well, I felt like a lot of the foreign policy stuff was not fleshed out in a way that satisfied me.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, quite honestly, Clinton was the most well-versed on these foreign
mm-hmm.
policy questions.
Mm-hmm.
She has all that experience as Secretary of State, and she sounded the most articulate and learned on those questions. Mm-hmm. However, I think that her positioning was very to the right, hawkish of most of the Democratic base.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that really stood out to me, that question at the end, when Anderson Cooper asked them, you know, who's the enemy that you've made in politics that you're most proud of?
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't single out one. She had a laundry list.
Mm-hmm.
But one item on her laundry list was the Iranians. And
mm-hmm.
I really cringed when she said that because it sounded like the Iranian people, right? Like
right.
to say the Iranians that way. And speaking of like a moral framing on these sorts of questions,
mm-hmm.
I really felt like that was the opposite of a moral framing for that kind of question. And I found it sort of un-Clinton-like.
Yes.
I was sort of surprised by that. But I was also sort of surprised that Sanders seemed weak in terms of knowledge on a lot of those foreign policy
yeah.
questions.
Yeah. Did you come away with a sense, I know it's just the first debate, but with a sense of someone doing unexpectedly well or unexpectedly poorly?
Well, I think that Clinton did expectedly well. Everyone knows she's a great debater. She was on her game. That was entirely expected. I think that Sanders, he seemed a lot less practiced than
mm-hmm.
Clinton. But I also think that's part of his appeal, because he really seems to be speaking from his gut,
mm-hmm.
especially on these economic inequality questions. And when he talks about the 1% and Wall Street and the comment about Congress doesn't control the lobbyists control Congress. I can't remember the exact phrasing,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I don't know that that was unexpectedly well, but maybe for people who haven't had a lot of exposure to Sanders, that sort of unpracticed but from the gut talk that really seems to be talking to the majority of Americans, that might have been unexpected and may bring him new supporters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sarah, I want to take a moment to highlight the writing that you've been doing about GOP presidential candidate Ben Carson. We've linked to those articles from stateofbelief.com, but could you just give us a taste of the work that you've done on him to encourage listeners to go read more of what you've written?
Well, Ben Carson is the favorite of many evangelical GOP base voters. And so I think that leads a lot of people to assume that he's also an evangelical Christian who shares many of their, not only their political convictions, but their theological convictions also.
Mm-hmm.
But Ben Carson is a lifelong Seventh-day Adventist, which for many evangelicals has long been sort of seen as a fringy sort of religion along with Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because a lot of his stances that seem to align very nicely with the Tea Party or religious right stances on issues like gun control are actually in conflict with his Seventh-day Adventism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the gun control question, I think what a lot of people probably don't know is that Seventh-day Adventists preach nonviolence. They're conscientious objectors in wartime. So his comments about, you know, people should arm themselves to protect themselves against gun violence, or that, you know, had the Jews of Germany in 1938 been armed against Hitler, they would have prevented the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
These things, notwithstanding the other problems with those statements, these things are in conflict with the theology of Seventh-day Adventism.
Mm-hmm.
And on the religious liberty question, for him to take the stance of the religious right is sort of not really in line with how Seventh-day Adventists see their own standing in American society,
mm-hmm.
because the theology and eschatology of Seventh-day Adventism is centered on Adventists being a minority religion
mm-hmm.
who worship on Saturdays and not Sundays, and their eschatology is built around the notion that the United States government will eventually, in league with the Catholic Church, mandate Sunday-only worship and thus persecute Seventh-day Adventists for worshiping on Saturday. So when he was asked the other day by Cheryl Atkinson about the end times, that comment he made has been circulating in the internet, and a lot of people have been suggesting that because he said we may be in the end times or something, mm-hmm. he said something extremely vague, but they haven't looked at the rest of what he said, which uncharacteristically was actually more in line with Seventh-day Adventism. He didn't say that he himself thinks we're hurtling towards the end times because of global turmoil, mm-hmm. particularly in Russia and the Middle East. He said, well, I would always shoot for peace, and I don't think that these things are inevitable. Mm-hmm. And that's actually more consistent with Seventh-day Adventist eschatology than it is with evangelical eschatology, mm-hmm. because Seventh-day Adventist eschatology is focused on what is happening here in America with regard to Seventh-day Adventists. It doesn't involve that whole, you know, Jesus right. coming back to Jerusalem on the white horse.
Right, right. Well, and I can tell you my experience through the years of working in coalitions on religious freedom issues, the Seventh-day Adventists have been among the most staunch believers in religious freedom. And mm-hmm. it's an interesting contradiction to look at.
Yes, very staunch believers in the separation of church and state and in the freedom to practice religion. Seventh-day Adventists have been in the forefront of many of the landmark Supreme Court cases on religious freedom.
Investigative journalist Sarah Posner writes widely about religion and politics for The Washington Post, Religion Dispatches, The Guardian, The Atlantic, The Nation, Salon, and is the author of the book God's Prophets, Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, it's just always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's always my pleasure.
Bishop Francis Quinn was installed as the Roman Catholic Bishop of Sacramento, California in 1979. Since retiring in 1993, Bishop Quinn has remained remarkably active and engaged in what today would be called progressive causes, but that many, perhaps most Catholics, would have considered mainstream just a few decades ago. With a unique long-term perspective on the changes his church has been through, Bishop Quinn has some well-founded opinions on where it ought to be going next under the leadership of Pope Francis. And I am delighted to be able to welcome Bishop Quinn to State of Belief Radio. Bishop Quinn, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief.
Well, it's good to be on with you, Welton.
Your New York Times piece raises three issues that you think the Vatican should be addressing. Would you describe those three issues?
Yes, the issues that were mentioned are really internal issues within the church. I'm not saying they're the most important issues because the worldwide issues are more important as to the monopoly or the morality of economic systems in the world, mm-hmm. the poor and the suffering, of course, the spiritual life and human sexuality. Those are really big international issues.
Mm-hmm.
But the three issues had to do with celibacy being mandatory for the priests in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two were women being ordained to the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
The third was forbidding divorced and remarried Catholics from receiving the Eucharist or Holy mm-hmm. Communion.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the issues that were featured in the op-ed in the Times.
Bishop Quinn, were those last three issues that you talked about, were those issues that moved to the surface of your consciousness because of your pastoral ministry?
Yes, because of my experience now with 68 years in the priesthood, as a matter of fact, and in a church which I stated in the op-ed I love deeply, and at the age of 94, I pray every night that I will die in the warm loving arms of the church. So the emphasis on internal matters within the church, I picked out these because of the experience in the pastoral ministry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I paid very careful attention to what you just mentioned about your love for the church that you stated so eloquently in the New York Times piece. It's kind of odd that I'm going to put together with you this particular name, but I learned a long time ago that during the so-called Reformation, the Reformation grew out of people who loved the church. They weren't trying to destroy the church. They loved the church. And that's what I was reminded of as I read your piece. The best reform in the church, it seems to me, comes from people not angry at the church, but who still love the church and want it to live up to what it should be. That's what I hear you saying when you say that.
That's absolutely right, Walton. Martin Luther was indeed
right.
A priest, and he was doing it for love of the church.
Right.
I understand that very truly.
Yeah.
That's why I think we're all really one and should be back as one family.
Right, right. Do you believe that Pope Francis has some of these same thoughts that you've just elaborated, even if he hasn't raised these issues so directly? Are they there in his mind, do you think?
I think they are. That's why I really wrote the piece in the New York Times, because I remember that he said at the extraordinary synod last year to the bishops, "Bishops, speak courageously and listen humbly."
Hmm.
And so I feel he has the same thoughts that I've just been expressing.
Yeah.
And I think he's brought a wonderful spirit to the cooperation and the collaboration among the churches.
Bishop Quinn, you have a deep understanding of the way the Catholic hierarchy operates. With the Synod on the Family underway, a number of bishops have just written to the Holy Father with the complaint that this synod is structurally slanted toward progressive voices being heard. What was your reaction to this letter, and what does it tell us about what's happening at the Vatican right now?
Well, first of all, the report on this letter has been somewhat garbled, or the media in dealing with it have gotten different facts, and nothing's really been confirmed on it. Some of the cardinals whose names are connected with it say they've never seen the letter, didn't know about it, certainly didn't sign it. And then others indicate that they knew about it and agree with it. I think it's what Pope Francis called for. He says, "I want to hear from all sides. I don't want you to just say what you think I believe and want to hear you say." But when you talk about slanting the preparations or the reports on it to the progressive side, that might just balance off, because for about 400 years, not always but often, it's been slanted to the conservative or traditional side. And maybe Pope Francis is just trying to bring it back center, so that all sides are heard.
My guest is the Most Reverend Bishop Francis Quinn, who retired as the Roman Catholic Bishop of Sacramento, California in 1979. Bishop Quinn, many Catholic leaders are afraid that Pope Francis is working for too much change too fast, but as I understand it, you'd like to see him go further. Would you talk about why you think a Vatican III Council would be a really good idea?
Well, I think it would be a good idea hoping that to that council would be invited lay people, men, women, young and old, scientists, appropriate academics of all kinds, also officials of all the churches, the faiths, so that we would really hear from those who would bring a contribution to the church,
mm-hmm.
from the academic world and from family life and all those things. And if that were the group, perhaps the bishops would be the ones that have the vote, the final vote, at least at this point in history,
mm-hmm.
but that the others would have at least a voice where they would be heard there very clearly. And I also think that it should be under the unifying guidance of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church believes that the Holy Father, the Pope, is the successor of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ensures a unity to the thing so that it doesn't scatter in all directions.
Yeah.
A unity among the Christian churches and among other faiths with the Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would, if it's set up that way, would be very healthy to study deeply and seriously the four or five points that I mentioned
mm-hmm.
earlier.
Mm-hmm. How would that actually happen? That if there were to be a Vatican III council, how would that come about?
Oh, it would be for Pope Francis to call it, and then many, many people in the Vatican and around the world would work on preparing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would need a lot of preparation from the other parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
not just the Western Hemisphere, but from Asia, from Latin America, from Africa, from all points of the world, so that the people of those parts of the world would be heard also.
Yeah.
And it would take a lot of organization, probably take 3 or 4 years in preparation.
Yeah. The people who would attend a Vatican III Council, if your hopes were fulfilled, would be much more diverse than the people who've been in other church councils. Would that be the call, the decision of the Pope, or are there other voices that have sway on how much diversity is there?
It would be initiated by the Pope,
mm-hmm.
but the other nations, I'm sure, under Pope Francis, would have just as much a say as mm-hmm. the Western Hemisphere
mm-hmm.
Church, Western Europe, United States, Canada, and all those,
mm-hmm.
which may have had an overriding position in the last council.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, because every nation has been represented in Vatican II
mm-hmm.
and probably in most councils that preceded it
mm-hmm.
through the 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So he would initiate it, but from then on it would be put into the hands of representatives around the world.
Yeah. I have a curiosity question. Is there a time in recent church history that you would say is parallel to the situation the Vatican finds itself in today? And what can we learn from those past experiences?
Oh, the past councils, yes, they've dealt with even probably heavier crises than we're experiencing now, and we've learned from all of them. I don't know how many councils there have been, maybe several hundred,
mm-hmm.
but they've all been international councils as much as the world was known at that time,
mm-hmm.
and I think we've learned a lot of things since then. We gotten over the dominance of the church, as was evidenced in the actions of the church at the time of the Crusades and the Inquisition,
mm-hmm.
those dark times of the church.
Sure.
We've learned to come ahead from that point, certainly. I think we have a long ways to go. Mm-hmm. We'll always be learning more and more. The difficulties of dealing with women's ordination and celibacy of the priest mm-hmm. is because there are good arguments on both sides of that question, and it's some of the things that we have to untangle along with science. Science and the faith are not in conflict. There's one truth, God's truth, and it's just approaching that truth and comprehending it through two different paths, mm-hmm. faith and science.
Right. So true. Bishop Quinn, you obviously have a level of hospitality for change that's missing in a lot of religion, not just in the Roman Catholic Church, but in a lot of other churches as well. How much have you changed over the years? You come to talk about issues that some people want no one to talk about, really. How have you changed through the years of your priesthood?
Oh, very much. As a young priest, you're sort of so busy with pastoral work that you don't get a chance to reflect on the concepts and the issues that swirl around us in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But as you get older, and especially when you're retired, you can reflect a little better.
Mm-hmm.
Say that I always end up reflecting the right way or to the right conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
But I have changed greatly, yes.
Well, and not only are you not afraid of change, you also are clearly a visionary person. And I'd like, if you would, to talk about your vision of the Catholic Church in the next century or two. What would you like it to look like? What role should it play in the world? And what do you base that vision on?
Well, let's see. I would have a vision, right or wrong, that our first need is what the Gospels kept telling us. Remember the widow and the orphan.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the poor, the suffering from pain or sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
All the people who are hurting in the world. Mm-hmm. I would say the churches together should focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then things like, for some reason or other, most of the controversies that have been in the Catholic Church in recent years seem to swirl around human sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should focus on that question to just work with scientists as well as people of faith to figure out what's the proper way of understanding human sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would see the church joining ecumenically with all the churches and faiths. Because, again, we believe in one God, and we're all worshiping and adoring that one God in mm-hmm. different ways. And I think God understands that we're trying to approach God in the best way we can, each one of us. And we can come together because we have so much in common.
Mm-hmm.
I would see that as a focus.
Before we go, I really want to highlight Behind Closed Doors, Conflicts in Today's Church, the book that you published just last year. This is, I understand, it's partly fictional, but it's also grounded in reality. I'd like for you just to say a few words that describe the book for our listeners.
Well, it's part fictional, part novel, part truth. In a way, it's autobiography in many ways. There are three characters in it who are studying for the priesthood, become priests. One becomes a bishop. And then there's a woman in it involved in a somewhat questionable relationship with one of the priests. However, as it turns out, it's a platonic relationship. It's a priesthood in which the priest is faithful to his vows of chastity and celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's involves one of the priests going from continent to continent working on Catholic relief services. And so he gets into a lot of fictional trouble. The exciting and sexy parts of the book, if you could call it that, are fictional.
Yeah.
The other parts of the book are trying to let people know what a priest's life is like. They only see him from Sunday to Sunday, and they wonder what he does all week. This is what I was trying to do. The royalties of the book are all going to a facility out here in Sacramento called the Quinn Cottages, which brings in men and women who are homeless, gives them lodging and food and all for 2 years, and helps them as they work themselves to find a job, get a car, work in a way to so that after 2 years they can graduate from Quinn Cottages and go on to the world as productive citizens.
The Most Reverend Francis Quinn is the retired bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Sacramento, California. His thoughtful op-ed on where the church he has served since 1946 should be headed can be found in the New York Times, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Bishop Quinn, I have to tell you, it's an honor to be able to interview you. I happen to come from a tradition, the historic Baptist tradition, that some people would say we come from traditions that have been in conflict and contradiction to each other. I want you to know, after talking with you, I think that you are my brother, and I am so happy to be inspired by your vision. Bishop Quinn, I really thank you for taking the time to talk with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I'm a brother to you, Welton. God bless you.
A few weeks ago, my wife and I were privileged to be invited to Los Angeles for a special preview of a major new documentary miniseries. It's titled Belief, and it premieres Sunday, October 18th on the OWN Television Network. This is a massive undertaking, and I am happy to welcome one of the executive producers, David Shadrach Smith, to State of Belief Radio. David, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, when we were all out there together for the premiere, I was impressed, David, by the amount of passion that Oprah brought to this whole endeavor. And it was almost as if she was saying, you know, I've kind of done everything else because I really wanted to do this. That tells me how important it was for her. I know it was important for you because she talked about those who had worked on this with such respect. What was the genesis of this whole documentary series?
I'm glad you got to see some of it, and I'm excited to share the whole series, we all are, with the world. You know, it began 3 years ago with us coming to Oprah with this crazy idea, very ambitious idea. Let's look at the whole world of belief and tell the story, very personal stories about how people engage and practice and question and seek. And, of course, that was so much part of Oprah's personal journey through her own career and life that she engaged immediately. But as we were talking about the genesis of this series with her, we had all these plans about production schedules and budgets and how we're going to go about it. And the first question she asked is, what do you believe? And we didn't have an answer right then and there, but it made it very clear that this whole endeavor was going to be very personal, both for Oprah and for us. And I think that comes through it. That was part and parcel of how we approached this series. It's not a history of belief. It's not a survey of all the faiths and religions in the world. We don't talk to experts. We engage people in their stories of belief. Mm-hmm. And I think Oprah has shared her story in so many ways, and this is exactly where she's at right now, mm-hmm. and it just resonated for all of us and across the whole series.
Well, unlike Oprah, David, I'm not going to ask you what you believe, but I am going to ask you, what got you interested in being a part of this?
Throughout my career and the career of Michael Davey and Eric Strauss, who are co-directors and really came up with this idea, you know, we traveled all over the world filming for National Geographic and Discovery and even for Oprah's channel on other shows. And I think as we move around the world, we encounter the variety of the way people engage in practicing what they believe. And some of it is so remarkable and so far away from ourselves that it always felt like if we could just connect all the dots, we would find this kind of human soul, this human heart that can connect us. And I think that's part of what we went into this series to try and do, was not look at what divides us, but look at what unites us. And and as we have spent our whole lives really all over the world, I think this was the chance to kind of say, hey, we're all in this together. Let's connect the dots. Let's find that common core of the search for meaning and purpose that we've encountered in our lives. So it was an incredible chance to do something ambitious and also hopefully very inspiring to people.
I have to tell you that I immediately was blown away by the cinematography, just the dynamics and the expertise that you all brought to the way in which you would cover the subject of belief. Talk for a minute about the excellent creative team that was brought together to do this filming.
The team was amazing, is amazing, and everybody brought their best self to this project. And we had a big challenge in portraying on television something as invisible and as ethereal as belief. And so we thought long and hard about how we were going to create a sense of power and emotion and pick that divine moment where belief becomes very real for people. And I think that became a filmmaking question as much as a philosophical question. You know, we did use a lot of very cutting-edge technologies, some phantom cameras which show things in incredible slow motion, to octocopters and moving time lapses. So we did bring all of what was available to this, but we had also really set ourselves the goal of creating something that would give viewers an experience of how beautiful and big and also very intimate belief can be. And I think, you know, creating the visual style to match that intention was something that everyone on the team was engaged in.
Yeah. Was there one moment in there that stood out for you as just one of those breathtaking moments that you wouldn't forget?
I definitely feel like there were more than one.
I'm sure.
Almost everyone was that kind of level of experience from watching. We filmed with a free solo climber who scaled a 1,000-foot peak with no ropes and no gear and just this confidence in himself, and watching him, you know, small man on a rock with, you know, on that edge of life and death was to me, you know, this breathtaking moment of understanding how fragile we are.
Yeah.
And then on the other end, you know, watching this 13-year-old boy in Hungary go through his bar mitzvah, and to see the way that he saw himself as a transmitter of his tradition and a messenger kind of the passage of all that knowledge through him that he will have to carry on. You know, that to me was a powerful, powerful moment of realizing this story, this arc of human history that is all centered around those very universal questions from the beginning of time. You know, who am I? Why am I here? What's my purpose? What's the meaning? So, you know, every story engaged on that level. And so they were all amazing moments to stop and reflect on that.
I just have to say, I can't get out of my mind the impact of the way in which you filmed 70 million people looking at a celebration in Hinduism and the power that that conveyed. So I understand not having just one.
Yeah, that was a big one.
David, what would you like viewers to take away from this seven-night series?
You know, I think the question that Oprah asked us at the very beginning, what do you believe, is what I hope will engage viewers as well. You know, to look at themselves, the role of their own beliefs in their lives, the traditions that they come from, the choices that you have surrounding beliefs, and to be open to seeing other ways of thinking and other ways of practicing that really bring us back to that common human core. And I think the biggest takeaway that we all hoped for was that people would feel a connection.
Mm-hmm.
People would see, oh yeah, we're all in this together. There's a lot of different pathways, but we're all trying to get to some similar place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I hope is going to be the takeaway, as well as just a really great viewing experience as an audience, which we didn't want to forget at any point in this series.
I tell you, one of the things that struck me, I think, as most powerful in watching this is the freedom that was involved in it. This whole series does not infringe on anyone's freedom. It doesn't preach to anyone. It doesn't say you've got to feel this way about it. There is a freedom for every viewer to form his or her own opinion. And I think that's just remarkable.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. You know, certainly that was kind of a risk going in. Would people be open to looking at and experiencing other faiths, other ways of believing, or would people recoil from that and say, but this is my way and this is the true way? And I think we certainly don't provide any answers to any of these questions, and part of that was making sure that we rooted all these stories in very personal journeys of the participants in each of the stories we tell. But so far, I have to say, and you've been at some of the screenings, I'm wildly amazed and impressed and so glad to report that people are really engaged in this larger idea of faith and belief being important and central to our lives and critical to our communities and to our world today, and looking beyond the conflicts and the headlines and some of the things that divide us and really finding out what unites us.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was certainly going to be one of the sort of most hopeful and yet riskiest positions to take on this series, and I'm really encouraged so far to see the incredible openness across so many different communities and faiths to what this series can be.
I grinned when you open by saying that in the initial conversation, Oprah asked you what you believe. Can I ask you what working on this project did to you? Did it change the way you see the role of different faiths in our society and our world? What was the impact on you?
Definitely. I think all of us were changed and transformed by making this series. And for me, it really re-engaged this notion that we witnessed around the world that practicing some kind of ritual, some kind of rite, some kind of way of gathering together as a community or family or even just with yourself to stop, think, engage in a deeper spirit, that is something that is universal, and it's something that I think I had lost over the years and came back very much thinking, okay, how can I put some of this practice back into my life? You know, how can I take that time every week or even every day to stop and be conscious and stop and think about things that are bigger than, you know, whatever problem or obstacle or thing that I'm running to right now? And I think, you know, when I saw how that worked across the world and how important it is to all of us, that was very inspiring. And now I'm hoping I can pass that along to my family and create that kind of meditative, spiritual, and important critical space in my own life.
Yeah. Well, it's a fabulous project. I said to Oprah one-on-one at dinner that night, when you think about how much negative publicity religion has attracted in the last year or two and some of the really harsh things that have been said about religion, after watching those two installments that we watched of Belief, I think I had never been more proud to identify myself as a religious person. David Shadrach Smith is one of the executive producers of the new documentary miniseries titled Belief, which starts Sunday, October 18th on the OWN Television Network. We'll link to schedule information from stateofbelief.com. And David, I really do thank you for taking time to talk with us today, share with us some of your experiences, and try along with me to convince people that this is worth canceling anything else to do if they can see this film. Thanks for being with
Clear
us.
Clear your week. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. My goodness, I like this week's show. For almost 10 years now, State of Belief Radio has been made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. As we get closer to the end of this year, please remember that your financial contribution to our show is tax deductible. I want to encourage you to consider committing to helping keep this show on the air and to helping expand the reach of our program. Please visit stateofbelief.com for more information. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, while you're there, you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show, as well as an archive of past shows, extended interviews, and transcripts. I bet you know someone who would benefit from hearing what you've just heard. Well, tell them about it, please. I encourage you to share this program with them. Offer to sit down and listen to a program with them. We make it really easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter, and of course, at stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today, a member of Interfaith Alliance today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was. Mm-hmm.